Coming up on today's show...
Playback is such a massive part of every top 40 act now, even with a massive band on stage. It's just part of how we roll. I look at it like another band member.
You're my painkiller when my brain gets bitter. You keep me close. You keep me close. I got front row seats for
Welcome to another new episode of Now Hear This Entertainment, featuring interviews with guests who are having success in entertainment, primarily music. I am Bruce Wozniak, talking to guests who are singers, songwriters, musicians, recording artists, and more from the worldwide music community. Get in touch with me by writing to podcast@nhte.net, or instead of email, you can DM me through the @NowHearThisEntertainment Instagram account. Remember, too, about the other free option for interaction with this show that I have started mentioning the last few weeks, Featured Up, which you can find a link to in this episode's description. Joining me today on the Now Hear This Entertainment guest line from Los Angeles, my guest is a music director, producer, session drummer, composer, and mix engineer. He has worked with the likes of Scott Weiland, BB Rexha, Tori Kelly, Haley Steinfeld, Nick Lachey, Disney, and many others. He has appeared on TV shows such as Good Morning America, The View, The Arsenio Hall Show, Late Night with Seth Meyers, and Last Call with Carson Daly. He has achieved multi-platinum success as a drummer and engineer, as well as music-directed multiple major label tours. And he has composed, recorded, and produced songs for feature films, movie trailers, and TV shows. You've been hearing a song that he engineered and played drums on called Painkiller by Rule. Welcome to Now Hear This Entertainment, Mike Avename.
Yo, thank you.
Absolutely, Mike. Thank you. I appreciate making time to talk with me today. The song that was just playing, called Painkiller, I mentioned that you engineered and played drums on, but tell us all about that. It has become a wildly successful track.
Yeah, it's a really interesting song. I had been touring with Rule playing drums prior to working on any of his records and got hit up by his producer, M Phases, to work on the track. And he's the kind of producer that really wants you to give him something interesting. So I went into it with the idea of trying to create something that was strange, almost didn't feel like real drums. And, you know, that's where we landed, what you were hearing. But the primary sound of that whole drum tone is interesting because it's really just one microphone. It's obviously more in the mix. I always end up recording a lot of microphones, but the sonic character of that whole drum sound really comes from one mic going through a specific piece of gear. And I always try to find something that's really interesting. And that, like any song when you work on it, it's just a song. Like, you have no idea what it's going to do. And but I was always super proud of how that turned out. And it's a drum reference that people ask me for frequently. A lot of people that hire me are like, oh, I want my drums to sound like Painkiller. You know, and then I go back on that and I wish, like, man, I wish I took more pictures of that session, you know, because it was just another day for me, you know, like, and I vaguely remember how I did it, like, in terms of where the microphones were positioned and stuff, but I can't remember the chain I used, and I'm not one to use the same thing. I change everything I ever do for every song, meaning preamps, compressions, routing, like, however I end up doing it, it's always different. So, yeah, that song was just another product of that, and obviously went on to do great things, and I'm very thankful for that.
But wait a minute, because it sounded like you said that you only mic'd the drum kit with one mic. So if that was the case, do you remember, was it on the floor, the bass drum, was it overhead?
So it's a full kit setup and a full microphone setup, but the sound that ended up being on the record is primarily the tone of one of the microphones.
Okay.
If I remember it and how I think I remember that, that one microphone was an AEA R84. It's a ribbon microphone. And that was kind of on a diagonal high up facing the kit. So not quite a drum overhead, but just a little bit back from it, kind of pointing down at the kit. And then I think I ran that through Universal Audio 610 preamp and a standard audio leveler. And that's getting most of the character. Like, they've got a crunch setting on that that makes everything kind of sound vintage lo-fi, almost breaking up. And that's, like, the primary tone. The, obviously, like, there's kick and snare mics and overheads and all kinds of stuff blended into that. But the actual vibe of it and what makes it kind of feel fake and sampled is that one microphone.
This is interesting, though. I recently, offline, not on the podcast, I recently, for my business, was talking to a producer about a potential client, a singer that I'm pursuing. And we were talking about, because you said that Rule, his producer, came to you and wanted you to do something that was going to get his attention, wanted you to be creative. And this conversation that I was having was about the engineer who will just do their job the way that it's traditionally expected to be. There's not a whole lot of creativity. It's just, I'm here to capture your sound and get it and move it along in the process. And it sounds like you're saying this was very much, I'm giving you creative license, Mike, as the engineer on this song.
Totally. I think I'm lucky in a way that a lot of people that do hire me are hiring me to do that. M-Phases in particular always has an idea of what he wants. Sonically, he'll give references and ideas and things that he wants it to feel like. But in terms of what the sonic thing ends up being, that's entirely on me. And I mean, I think I slightly have an advantage in the way that I'm also a producer and mixer. So from the sonic picture, I know how to get there. I try to deliver stuff to people already done. You know, I'm not planning on giving people raw drum files that they load in and then they're like, okay, well, now let me shape the thing. Like, mm-hmm. I'm trying to deliver it that when you pull it up in your session, it's done.
I like that.
Yeah, his guide was kind of like, I wanted to do this and let's see what you come up with. And that's where I landed. You know, I was trying to get something kind of crunchy and lo-fi, hip-hop, weird, you know, something interesting. I always want to give something interesting as opposed to just delivering a drum sound and leaving that for somebody else to do the work. I'm a big supporter of, like, trying to hire the people that you know are going to give you something really interesting to listen to. And there are so many musicians and producers and people like that out there that have an amazing sound. It's like, let's hire them to give me that as opposed to just being like, well, I could play this, but you might be able to play it better, and then I'll try spend 3 or 4 hours on it afterwards getting it to do what you could have just done if you gave it to me. You know, and a lot of these things are turned around really fast. Like, sometimes producers are working on tracks for months with programmed drums, and then they decide, you know, 3 days before the album is supposed to be delivered, like, let's put real drums on here. So a lot of it is always like, hey, where are you in 2 hours? Like, can you do this for me right now?
Wow.
Nearly all of them are like that.
Wow.
And this was one of those. It was kind of like tracked, engineered, set up, and delivered within probably 3 hours.
Mm. Well, and let's face it. You can be an engineer who is good at what he does, really likes his job, enjoys the work, does it, goes home, come back the next day, wash, rinse, repeat. But come on, you got to love it when you deal with someone like what you described that says, no, have fun with it, man. Like, do your thing. Show us who you are on the work you're going to do for my artist.
Absolutely. And I think a big part of it is just thinking a little bit more outside the box and creatively when I do it. I want someone to get it back and be like, I'm going to hire that person again, obviously. It's very helpful to offer something unique and also something very easy for the person on the other side. Like, they're not having to pull it in and be like, what is this for? What is this mic? Yeah. What do I do with this? How do I send that somewhere? Like, I want it to go in. You just load it up and you're like, man, that's done. Like, I don't need to do anything. And that's what I'm trying to hit. So, like, I think a lot of the time producers give me creative license, but they're also like, hey, this is what I want. So I give them what they want, but I always give a couple takes at the end where I do whatever I want to do. And I would say, like, at least 80% of the time they end up using the one that I just did.
Well, and that's also great advice for someone who's a session player that gets told, this is what we need, lay down this guitar and this song, and this is what we're looking for. And it's great advice to say, yes, absolutely. They're the ones paying you. Give them what they ask for. But give them something that shows your spontaneity, your creativity, improv a little bit. Give them something to compare it to. And then maybe they go, man, this is pretty cool. I like what you did. Or, you know, I like it. We're going to stick with what we asked for, but I'm definitely going to use you on another project. I see your vision.
Yeah, 100%. I think it's always worth mentioning. Just give me one more password. I can, like, just give you some options so that in case you want something. That's kind of how I always pitch it to somebody. Whether in my mind I'm thinking, like, I know I can do this better, you know, but I always am just like, yeah, let me just take a crack at it and give you something else so that if you, in the piecing together, want something else, you don't have to then call me back and tell me let's do it again, because I'm 100% sure that 20 minutes after we finish with the session, I pull the whole thing down. So, like, I always tell people this, like, be sure, because, like, I'm not one of these people that has this set up. Like, this is for your song. Mm. And when I move to the next song, it's going to be completely different.
Yeah.
So we need to always be sure. And I worked on a session yesterday morning with some clients that I work with all the time. And we did the whole, like, let's play whatever you want for the first, like, three or four takes. And then the producer was like, you know what, man? Like, can you just play all the fills exactly the same as I played them on the reference, because I'm attached to it and that's what I want. And I was like, yeah, sure. So, like, I gave him one take, like, identical to his programming but with my sounds.
Mm-hmm.
And then I gave him one more that was just, you know, nonsense. Mm-hmm. So that he, in case at a later point, can decide, like, actually, yeah, I want that fill instead. Yeah. You know, but yeah, sometimes it takes a second for them to realize, like, yeah, actually, I want it exactly how it is.
Fantastic, fantastic. We're off to a great start. And I mentioned that you're calling in from Los Angeles, but as the audience can tell by your accent, you're not originally from there. When and why did you move to LA?
I am from Sydney, Australia, originally. My accent is very strange. I think at this point, I don't notice it, obviously, but I'm told frequently that I sound like I'm from Boston.
Wow, not at all.
Yeah.
I'm here to say not at all.
Yeah, good. I finished high school in 2005 in Australia, and somebody I went to school with's boyfriend was in a band that was looking for a drummer to come to the U.S. to track on a record. So essentially, like, 2 weeks after I finished high school, like, I was on a plane coming out to America after I did all the auditions and stuff. And then was at Paramount making a record for like 3 or 4 months. And that was in 2006. I was 18 then. And that really just solidified my wanting to be here. I had always felt like I was born in the wrong country. I always used to tell my mom, you know, hey, why didn't you just have me in America? I just always felt like I needed to be in America. And, I was going to do whatever I needed to do to get here, you know? So, like, I really followed all those moments and instincts and opportunities that got me here. So I had done that. I ended up going back to Australia and for a couple years, stayed in Australia. I ended up playing in a band named Porcelain that had a record deal with Motown through Universal. And we did that for years. And eventually there was some politics involved and the band got dropped.
Mm.
And during that process, I got really lucky and won the green card lottery.
Mm.
And not long after that was granted, really, like, it's actually a much heavier process. And people realize, like, when you win, it takes another 7 or 8 months to actually get approval.
Wow.
But by the time I got the approval, I moved to LA like 6 days later.
Oh,
so that
boy.
Was the end of 2010. I had like 4 snare drums in a suitcase and like that was it.
Oh, gosh. And folks, there have actually been a handful of Australians on the show over time, some of which still live there, like episode 508, Natalie Gauci, who I know has a new album coming out next month, and others who live here in the States now. I will put a link to one or more of those on the show page for this episode on my podcast website, nhte.net, so you can go and listen to my interview with one or more of some of the other Aussies. Mike, it's one thing on the personal side to relocate to, in your case, Los Angeles, but on the business side, it's another thing to start getting some traction in a major music market such as that is. Tell us about navigating how to get work in LA.
Yeah, so for everybody, I think everybody's got an interesting story about coming here and trying to get anything. I felt like I was going to have an easier time on the basis of that I had come back and forth so many times prior to moving and like knew a lot of people and really thought people were going to help. But once I actually got here, you know, it's like all of a sudden everyone you know is ghost town.
Mm.
So when I moved here, I got a job at Sam Ash, like in the drum department, and just started working there and trying to meet people. It was really a tool for me to figure out like who the guys were in the scene, like who do I need to find, talk to. And I actually ended up with my first couple of like in town gigs from people coming into the store and being like, you know, you sound great, like you want to do a gig? So I got some gigs from that and was then talking to everybody I knew. At the time, everybody was like, you have to meet this guy Barry Squire. And for anybody who doesn't know, Barry was like the guy if you were trying to get on any major label gig or anything. Like he ran every audition for every major tour, like anything. And getting on that call list was pretty difficult. I met a lot of people that were getting called for everything and I just couldn't get a call. And eventually I did get a call. And I would say it was probably 2 years after moving to LA.
But wait a minute, does that mean that you did get on his list?
I feel like I never actually made it on that list. I became friendly with his wife and like partners and stuff. They would come to my shows and stuff, but he would still never call. And for no other reason than I just, you know, he had a lot of people that were his like go-to people. And I was like trying to sneak in there as a new guy in town. So I eventually got a call. I don't know. I got an email or something. I don't know how I got a call. It was for a Randy Jackson project. And I went and auditioned to that. Now, hold on. Let me step back for 1 second. Prior to that, I had been on a couple auditions. And every single time, it was between me and one other drummer at the end. And for some reason, I never booked it.
Oh.
And every time they were like, you're great, blah, 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 but we just like the other guy's look. Or you're great, and, you know, we just like, we need a tall guy. And, you know, it was it never had anything to do with music. And it was a very interesting thing to me at the time. And this will lead me to another story. But, like, I, at the time, was, like, super thin and, like, had long hair, looked like a full rock star, you know? Uh-huh. So, anyway, this first Randy Jackson gig, I ended up booking, and it was for a, like, very famous Russian rock artist. And that ended up being my first, like, kind of big U.S. run. We did Warped Tour that year and a bunch of other things and opened for Nickelback, and it was, like, a really amazing experience. I think I was probably 24 when that happened. And obviously, like I said, prior to that, I had been going on auditions and not getting them. And I think a big part of that was because I really looked like I should have been in Pantera.
Hmm.
And then, you know, back in town after the tour, started working on other things, production sessions, trying to get more work and trying to figure out what the next move was going to be. And I was actually in a recording session with another artist who was playing bass on the session, who got a call from Barry Squire at that session about an audition that was happening the next day.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, what is happening? Like, why? I just booked this gig. Like, I've been out on this gig. Why didn't he call me? And I said to the bass player, like, where's the audition? And he's like, it's at MI tomorrow at like 10 a.m. or whatever. And I was like, cool. So I went and got a haircut as a social experiment. And like, keep in mind, by this point I had long hair for like 6-7 years, you know.
Whoa.
And I cut it like fully off into like a full-on boy band haircut. And it was completely a social experiment.
Yeah.
I went to the audition without having a call, and when I got there, they were like, hey, what are you doing here? And I was like, what are you talking about? I got a call for the audition. And they were like, I don't think so. And I was like, well, I'm here. Like, what do you want me to do? Go home.
How would I know about this audition if I hadn't gotten the call?
That's right. Yeah. And I just was like, well, you know, I'm here. Like, what time can I do it? And they were like, oh, I don't know. I guess we'll slot you in at 12:45.
Nice.
That audition was for a band named Emblem 3, who were a young boy band that had done very well on X Factor that year. And I booked the gig.
Here you were with your boy band haircut.
That's right. Yeah. Wow. You know, like I booked the gig and also an audition that I wasn't supposed to be at.
Yeah.
And I booked that gig, you know, and that gig ended up being great. I probably had about 2 years worth of touring from them, maybe more, 3 years.
Wow.
And met some great people on that. Max Bernstein was the music director on that gig, and Max is like one of the premier music directors in the world, I'd say. He's Taylor Swift's guitar player among every other major rock star person that he's worked with. But yeah, he was the music director on that gig, and I met him, and that one gig kind of spawned, I feel like, the rest of what my live music playing career in America really became.
Mm, fantastic, fantastic. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention Caitlin Evanson, who was Taylor Swift's fiddle player. She was a guest on this show. I will put a link to my interview with her on the show page for Mike's episode on nhte.net. So back in the intro, I rattled off just some of the big names that you have worked with, Mike. I'm just going to pick out one, Scott Weiland, and ask you to tell us about getting that gig.
Yeah, so that was a wild experience in the best way. Weirdly, like one of the very first like big dates I ever went on with my wife was a Stone Temple Pilots show. Mm. You know, so years before, like I'm say at least 5 or 6 years prior to me actually getting the gig, I was playing with an artist named Sun Ray, an incredible Australian. His name is Ray Thistlethwaite, unbelievable Australian keyboard player and artist, and very successful. He's actually playing with Joe Satriani at the moment. And we would do these duo gigs in LA with him playing like left-hand key bass and keys and me on drums.
Mm.
There was a bar in town called Piano Bar that was like a really amazing spot. It had live music every night. It's obviously gone now, but it was really cool. It was a great hang, a lot of amazing music coming out of there. And I was playing in the bar with him, and had a guy like come up to me like, "Hey man, you know, you sound great. Like, you know, I'm going to hook you up." And, you know, in true LA fashion, I was like, yeah, okay, whatever, man. Like, great. Hey, nah, you know, who do you know? Like, I know people, you know.
Sure you do.
And it was, you know, loud yelling conversation in a bar. You know, yeah. I was like, okay, great, man. Yeah. Like, high five, cool.
Sure you
He's
do.
He's like, I'll give you my card. Give me my card. You know, let's talk. And never thought about it ever again after that night, you know. And
of course.
Weeks and weeks later, I get a phone call. It was like, hey, man, his name's Danny Thompson, great drummer, who is Alan Parsons' drummer and at the time Scott Weiland's drummer.
Wow.
And he was like, hey, I met you at Piano Bar. And I was like, oh, hey, what's up, you know? And he said, yeah, look, you know, Scott needs a drummer. I am busy like bouncing between both gigs and can't do everything. Mm. So do you want to take an audition?
Crazy.
And I was like, yeah, great. So I sent in a video audition that led to me getting called to go to the studio and actually have like a playing audition with the band. And this was for Scott's solo project, which was called Scott Weiland and the Wildabouts, and went and played with them and essentially like got the gig and was in Houston 24 hours later playing the first show. And you know, and then toured with him for essentially up until he passed away, and was lucky enough to work on the record. I played, I think, on 4 or 5 tracks on the last album. I wrote one of the songs. It ended up being like a true, if you know, if you want to call it this, like grunge experience that someone my age didn't get to do, because like I was a child in the 90s, you know. So I really felt lucky that I got to feel what that would have felt like if I had done it then.
Mm.
It felt like the best cover gig ever, if that makes sense. just being able to play, obviously we played originals, but we played like Velvet Revolver tunes and STP tunes, and getting to do that with him and work with him was like kind of magical. Making that record was like a real record experience. Everyone in the room writing and recording with mic'd up, like just smashing it out. It was really cool.
So is the lesson in that, Mike, when Danny approached you and it's just kind of one of those, yeah, okay, sure, whatever. Is the lesson in that, that if you are an up-and-coming performer, you can't really dismiss anybody, because let's face it, all of us in the music business, we've all been in those conversations where you get the person that you're like, this person doesn't know anybody. Like, give me a break. The guy gave me his business card. He's a freaking realtor. You know, who does he know?
Yeah.
Is the lesson in that to just never discount who knows who and what they might be able to do for you?
Yeah, you just have no idea. This is a really random thing, but it's related to the same thing. I'll tell it in 1 minute. When I worked at Sam Ash, somebody came in one day and was like, hey, I want to buy that big electronic kit at the front. And I was stoked because, like, it was commission-based and that kit was like $10,000. So I was like, great. Like, started telling them about it. They were like, no. Like, I don't have time. Like, here's my credit card. Essentially hands me a Black American Express card and goes, you know, boom, let's go. And I was like, okay, great. And then they're like, can you come set it up? And I said, well, we don't really do that. And they were like, well, can you do it? You know, like, I'll pay you to come set it up. Here's my address. Pack it down. Bring it to my house. And I said, well, when I finish work, you know, I'll bring it to you. And they were like, okay, great. I packed it all down. Get the address. Drive somewhere up into the Hollywood Hills. And this was like when I first lived here, I had no money. I was working for $7 an hour. You know, I'm driving up there thinking, like, I'm going to get $50. This is going to be great. And I get up there. I ring the doorbell in like one of the most amazing houses I've ever seen. I have no idea what this person did. I walk in. They've already got the exact same kit set up in the lounge room. And I was like, hey. And they said, oh, yeah, you bring the drums. I was like, yeah. You already have this kit here. And they were like, yeah. We just buy one every year. And I was like, okay.
Wow.
And I said, where do you want me to set it up? And they were like, oh, don't worry about it. You can just keep it.
What?
Yeah.
Wow.
I was like, what? And they were like, yeah, it's all good. Like, you know, just help me set this one up a little bit and you can keep the other one.
Mm.
So I drove back to my apartment with a $10,000 electric drum kit in the back of my car.
With a whole lot more than $50.
Yeah. And years later, that ended up being the catalyst for what funded the first pieces of gear I bought for my recording studio.
Wow. Fantastic. You were kind of forced to change directions, though, due to getting injured. When was that? What happened? And then how did you make the transition into music directing as opposed to going some other route?
Yeah. So I was playing with an artist named Zella Day, who is an awesome artist, kind of like Lana Del Rey-ish, maybe a bit more rock. And I had been playing with her for a little bit, and then we booked this tour. And first day of the tour, I think we were in Kansas City, somewhere like that. I finished the show, go back to the bus. Like anybody that knows anything about touring, you need to try to utilize the bathroom at every place you can, because the bus bathroom is not a place to be utilized. And so I was like, oh, yeah, before we leave, like, I got to go back in. And not realizing that the bus driver hadn't lowered the bus back down. So when you're on a tour bus, it's hydraulic and it gets lowered down to the path. And I like went out quickly, opened the door, and the bus driver hadn't lowered the bus down. And like I got my foot caught between the bus and the path and fell over the front of it and snapped my right foot really badly. So ended up destroying the peroneal tendons and a bunch of things in my right foot. I ended up trying to do most of that tour on a double kick pedal, playing the main kick with my left foot and a remote cable hi-hat for my right hand, and would play the open hi-hat with my left hand and open and close it with my hand.
Wow.
So I was trying to do everything I possibly could. Just another thing of like, you just got to, you know, show must go on type situation. But I couldn't walk. I was on crutches. I couldn't walk. And eventually, by the time we'd gotten to New York City, I had a doctor be like, you got to leave and go home, because like you're never going to be able to play or walk if you don't go get some serious rehabilitation.
Yeah.
So I ended up having to leave that tour. And long story short, I didn't play or couldn't really play for about a year after that.
Whoa.
It destroyed me. Like, I mentally, physically, everything. You know, I really went through a position during that time of, like, what am I going to do with my life now? Yeah. I was, like, I don't know, 26, 27 or something. And was like, my life's over. I have always done production and mixing and been really heavy in the technical world. And I've always had a massive fascination in arrangement. And, you know, up to that point, I had already done a bunch of like TV commercial compositional things. And so then I just started leaning into the idea of like, what am I going to do here? And two things kind of happened during that period. I had a friend that was working with a big licensing house doing loads of music for TV and films. So he threw me a major bone and was having me do a ton of compositional stuff for TV shows.
Uh-huh.
So I was doing that, and at the same time had ended up getting a call from a friend of mine recommending me to play drums on something. And at the time, I wasn't telling anybody that this had happened.
Oh.
I was like, yeah, sure, man. You know, like, let me have a chat to the guy. So anyway, I get a call from someone at the record label, and they were looking for a drummer. I obviously tried to weasel my way out of the conversation in a way that I was like, hey, you know, I'm like, I'm not really working on drum stuff at the moment. But I just threw into the conversation, if you need a music director, hit me up and I'd be happy to help. And he goes, actually, you know, I've got this project that I'm working on. Like, where do you live? And I said, I'm in Studio City. And he's like, all right, great. Well, like, come down to the Disney lot tomorrow and let's take a meeting.
Oh my gosh.
And that was the start of that. I went to the Disney lot the next day, like, ended up on the first project I worked on for them was the Radio Disney Music Award arrangements for Moana with Auli'i, who is Moana, and Alessia Cara and Jordan Fisher. And it was like a big, you know, segment of the Radio Disney Music Awards. And that was like a big success for them. And then I just started getting calls, you know, after that for a lot of Hollywood record projects and Disney projects. One of those artists is still one of my clients. One of them is heavily focusing on acting at the moment, but is still one of my clients. Like, so these have all ended up being like really long-term relationships, like at least 7 years or so.
But when you said during that phone call, if you ever need someone to MD a show for you, you know, let me know. That was just on a whim? There was no experience to draw from?
Yeah. I mean, like, I knew I could do it. I have been on many tours prior to that, like, running playback and, like, making edits for the music directors and, like, all that kind of stuff. So, you know, I am a very musical person. So, like, I know from the arrangement perspective and all of that, like, I have no problems doing arrangements and reharmonizations and, like, doing all that kind of stuff.
Gotcha.
I guess was always looked at that no one really knows I can do it or thinks I can do it because I play drums.
I see.
You know,
I see.
I also play a lot of other instruments really well, but because people know me for playing drums, they always presume the drummer doesn't know what they're talking about. But, but weirdly, there's a lot of very, very, very successful drummers that are also music directors.
Okay.
So yeah, it was just a statement based on like, that's all I've got for you right now.
Yeah.
You know, I knew that I couldn't play if he needed me to play.
Yeah.
So I was like, yeah, if you need an MD, like, hit me up.
And, fantastic.
He did right that second.
Fantastic. I'm joined today on the Now Hear This Entertainment guest line from Los Angeles by music director, producer, session drummer, composer, and mix engineer Mike Avename. Visit his official website at mikeavename.com. I will have a link to it on the show page for this episode on my podcast website, nhte.net. Lots to see there, including information on his studio in the NoHo Arts District of LA, an equipment list, and the ability to book a remote session from his studio and what he can do for you. Of course, he is on social media. At the bottom of his website, there are logos to connect with Mike on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. He is on YouTube as well. In fact, the videos on his channel have gotten a combined total of over 226,000 views, so be sure to look for him on there as well. As I mentioned at the very beginning of today's show, there is a new way, a third method, of interacting with me and this show in addition to email or social media DMs. That is through Featured Up, and regardless of what platform you are listening to this interview through, you will see a link in the episode description to be taken to my page on their site. There is no cost to use their service. It is a portal where you can either type in a message or record up to 60 seconds of audio to send to me. questions about this or any episode of NHTE or suggestions, comments, whatever you have, you can now send to me that way. I also put a featured up logo on my podcast website, nhte.net, that you can tap or click on as well to go to my page on their site. Mike, there have been some other really cool experiences that you've had, such as meeting people at the record labels and music directing some large projects there. You mentioned one of them, the Radio Disney Music Awards segments.
Yeah, I think it's very important to realize when you're on the business side of the music thing that you have to know people to get stuff. You know, it helps to be able to back it up by being an incredible musician or doing anything like that, but you still got to find the connects. I think I've always kind of looked at it that you need to be lucky in the way that you meet the right people that are going to help you, but you still need to be able to back it up. You know, so you can't be lucky and know people and suck at your job, you know. But it's definitely worth, you know, trying to meet everybody you can and have those connections. So a lot of my stuff has come through managers, record labels, A&R people, like just meeting people through people in a business sense, mostly the corporate stuff, you know, because they recommend you for more. A lot of management firms and other people that I've worked with, and that has all really stemmed from the record label situation. It has always been a thing for me to just be easy to work with. I always just want to do the best possible job I can, and that's, I feel like, led me to lots of other situations. The music, I almost think, is like something that they think about at the end. You know, they're always just like thinking, is this person going to get it done, etc. The talent portion of it is just like a given. They just presume that that's going to be the way it is. So like one of my first clients through Hollywood Records on a music thing was an artist named B. Miller, who's done amazing things, is like one of the most talented people I know. And I'm still her music director. I've played drums on tour with her. I've played guitar in like promo stuff for her, lots of things like that. And through them, I also worked with Jorge Blanco, a band called Boy Epic, Olivia Holt, who's a very successful musician and actor. Lots of stuff has really stemmed through that connection. And through that, I've also ended up with other labels and stuff. By B. Miller had a feature with an Island Records artist, Universal artist named Noted, N-O-T-D. They're a big Swedish production duo, like incredible musicians, unbelievable producers, lovely humans, some of my best friends now. But I met them through B because they had a collaborative track that was the number one dance song around the world for a while called I Wanna Know. And at the time, the boys had no MD, like nothing, and we had like a bunch of TV stuff that had to get done. So they had flown here from Sweden, and by sheer coincidence, I ended up being their music director.
Wow.
And still am very heavily connected with those guys, and I love them, and they're incredible and do amazing work. But yeah, again, just another like link connection through that. And that connection has led me to other work through their management company. You know, so it's all kind of just, you know, it's very important, I feel like, for anybody that's trying to get into this, just be cool. Like, make sure you're really good at your job. Don't ever let things fall by the wayside. Like, stay on top of it. Just get it done. Be easy and flexible. And it's sometimes really hard to do what they're asking you to do when you know it shouldn't be that. But you just got to do it sometimes. Sometimes you have to fight for it. I had a promo with Noted and another artist named Georgia Koo for another song that did really, really well called So Close. And we were doing the Sirius XM room in New York City, which is like a stripped down acoustic environment. And we're talking about like an absolutely slamming EDM track. So I was like, how are we going to do this? And the guys are great musicians. And my concept was like, let's have them play piano and guitar and have Georgia Koo sing, and like, let's do this like stripped. And everyone at the record label fought me on it. You know, they were like, nah, we're not doing this. It's not going to work. It's not going to sound good, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, we ended up doing it. And then, of course, everyone was like, this is the best, you know. But sometimes you just got to fight for it. You know, like I was 100% sure the guys were going to be able to do it. I would not have put them in that position if I thought it was going to fall. I just felt like musically I know them better than people that were working with them at the time. And I really pushed to have that go down, and it was great.
But I think it's important for people to hear a story like that, because as much as we're hitting on a real lot of highlights that you've had, you do have to acknowledge the times that, yeah, there is going to be some tension, there is going to be some conflict. You started to talk before about sync and TV, and that's such a popular thing nowadays. Everybody just, TV and film is something that people have almost become hyper-focused on. And on the one hand, you can tell a story about that leading to artist production and mixing, Olivia Rodrigo for one, but I know you also have, you know, kind of a pro and con. Like, sure, that's a highlight, but I think you have a really recent story of something that didn't go too well in that realm, yes?
Yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of stuff. Like, it's a really interesting world that it, you know, a lot of it is very, very, very brief specific. So they really are looking for a particular thing. Sometimes there's batch things where they don't particularly care. It just needs to be on a certain sonic level, which is quite high. You know, a lot of these companies want stuff that sounds like it's made by the best producers on the planet. So it really, really helps your production chops having to compete like on that level and really make stuff sound like it's radio ready, but it's not. It's not for that. So, like, I've had a lot of practice with that kind of stuff and doing tracks in that capacity. I have also played on lots and lots of things from the drum perspective that is all very also TV specific. A lot of those things are like, you have to stay out of the way of dialogue and all kinds of things, so you can't play like how you would usually play. I had a circumstance on a session that I was doing where it was for like a lot of these companies make records, you know, so they put out a record of, I don't know, 20 tracks of punk music, so that people, when they're looking for punk music, go and find this record and they can license anything from that. So I was playing drums on this record and play the thing, like, you know, doing my best Travis Barker, and, you know, they come back and they're like, nah, you know, like, it needs to be more, you know, like, more Sex Pistols, like, rough, like, make it rough. So then I'm like, okay, cool, yeah, I do it again, send it back. They come back, yeah, it's good, it's good, it's just too good. And I'm like, what? They were like, it just sounds too good, it's not, it doesn't feel real, you know. And I said, oh, well, I mean, like, I'm a good drummer, you know, like, this is what I got, you know. And they were like, let's take another pass at it. So I did it again, and they were like, yeah, I don't know, man. Like, it's just, it just feels too put together. And eventually I was like sitting in my studio just thinking, like, I just can't do this. Wow. Like, I can't make myself a worse musician. And then randomly was like, I wonder what will happen if I just set my whole kit up left-handed. Like, literally, like, playing the bass drum with my left foot, like, every, not playing open-handed, like, playing with my left hand on the hi-hat. And, like, you know, for any real drummer or musician out there, they know this is very, very difficult to do. So I did. I removed everything. I set it up left-handed. I re-mic'd the whole kit, re-recorded it, sent it back, and they were like, this is great! You know, so I was like, because I was really struggling. Yeah. Really struggling. Like,
oh my gosh.
But again, like, just out of sheer, like, I need to do this job. You know, I need to give them what they want. And I wasn't willing for it to be something that I was going to let go of. Like, I find it really difficult if somebody's not satisfied. I fortunately, you know, I know this sounds, you know, like a very up myself thing to say, but I don't really run into those things very often where people are like, this is not good. But if it does happen, like, I'm unwilling to let it go. It's just not how I roll. Like, I can't let it go. I wouldn't be able to sleep. But yeah, this was one of those things. And then, you know, eventually I figured it out, but it was like,
wow.
It felt very strange to be re-recording something as bad as possible.
No doubt.
But it worked, you know, and it got them the product that they needed.
Yeah, you're not going to get too many more like that. And I still admire, though, the creativity in saying, okay, I've done as good as I could. They've acknowledged that it's too good. I still need to do this in a way that pleases the client. So what can I do? And I admire your creativity in coming up with something that achieved the ultimate goal. During the break, when I was giving out all your online destinations where people can find you, I mentioned your studio. Tell us about building that and recording some big songs there as an engineer.
Yeah, so that build happened while I was injured. So it was another one of those, like, what do I need to set myself up for here in case I can't ever play ever again? You know, so that studio build was very much I need to make a space here that is functional for many reasons, because fortunately, like, I can play other instruments and I do production and all this kind of stuff. So I was like, I need to build like a kind of multi-purpose creative space that I can work out of regardless of what happens here. But I also wanted it to be really live sounding, because I want to record drums in there and I needed it to be big. You know, I don't want a dead room. I wanted like a big room with 20-foot ceilings. And so I went searching for a place and found a place with big, massive ceilings, and had some friends help me install floorboards in there. And my wife built some panels for the walls, and really just like collaborative effort of people really coming together to help me during this period, because I was in a bad spot.
Physically.
So I also during that time, kind of a bit before I got injured, I met an amazing producer engineer from Nashville named Bobby Holland. He has been like an astronomical source of everything for me, you know, just like referencing what I'm doing, mixes, listen to this. Like, you know, when I really started getting heavily into engineering, and I would send him like, you know, drum takes that I was doing, like, what does this sound like? Like, what can I improve? And has really been like a mentor to me and just freely giving me information and helping. And like, you know, so we met in 2013. He was at my house 2 days ago helping me rewire my patch bay from Nashville.
Wow.
He's an incredible human. And so, yeah, he was really helpful in that build in terms of where I should put things and the expansion of my sound, you know, like really pushed me in different directions in terms of like making me realize what I wanted, you know. And then that opened the black hole of creation there. So like I have, you know, many, many, many racks of outboard gear there. I don't work with any kind of DSP situation. Like I don't use Apollos and stuff. It's all like tube compressors, tube mixers, outboard pre's, like EQs, all sorts of outboard reverbs, tape machines, like all kinds of stuff. I really have gone deep in the creation engineering world. I'm a huge fan of like producer, mixer type people like Brendan O'Brien that kind of do the whole thing, who are also incredible musicians. So I wanted that, you know, I was trying to chase the like, how can I play but also engineer and also have like the coolest sound and have something really uniquely interesting. So my patch bays in those rooms are completely not normal to half normal or anything. I have to literally patch every piece into every piece. There's 10,000 cables sticking out of there because I change it for every song.
Every song.
Yeah, every song. Yeah.
Wow.
Different kits, different cymbals, different positions, different miking, like different preamps. I just am really trying to give somebody a uniquely individual thing every time I do it. And that's how I wanted to set that space up. It takes a lot longer, obviously, but I don't care. Like, I just am trying to have people walk away from it being like, this like changed my world, like changed my song, like changed everything. You know, you want, I know that when I've hired session musicians, I want something back that makes me go like, oh my God, you know?
Yeah.
I want to walk away from it being like, this was so worth it. Me being a multi-instrumentalist who's pretty proficient at a lot of instruments, I don't want something where I get it back and I'm like, ah, man, I just could have done that myself.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, so I don't want anyone to kind of be like, oh, I just could have programmed it. You know, my goal is like, you're getting something you are unable to program. You are unable to do this without hiring me.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Folks, back in March, I was in Las Vegas and I sat down with professional touring multi-instrumentalist Tracyon Martin for what ended up being episode 531 of this show. One of the things that came up in my discussion with her was the rare occasion when a musician has to sub out, and how sometimes they can just get away with recording some of the parts for playback during the live show. She also talked about being musical director for Melanie Fiona and Janelle Monáe. Mike, let's talk about live work for you. Music directing, playback for live shows, integrating MIDI into the live setups, as well as, you've touched on this a few times, actually playing a couple other instruments on some major shows.
Yeah, so there's so many different kinds of music directors. There are the music directors that like just MD stuff. So they come in, they do the arrangements, like they say what they want, and then there's a playback guy, and there's a this guy, and there's a that guy, you know? And then there is a whole school of music directors in town that do everything, you know, like run playback, do all the programming and everything like that. Because I am such a nerd, when I start on something, I get so deep into it. So playback has become a really wild obsession for me, and how to do it better, how to integrate it in really slick ways. I got really heavy into Max for Live. For anyone that doesn't know, it's like a programming portion of Ableton that essentially allows you to make any device that controls certain things. So I built devices that control auto-tune automatically and control patch changing for pedals via MIDI and like changing sounds and different ways to control time code and just all this stuff that really is like as something I've run into as a necessity during a show build where I'm like, man, I wish there was like a way that that person playing guitar didn't have to stand at their pedal board while they're soloing because they need to use the wah. So I was like, I wonder if there's a way I can build a device that does the wah for them so that they can go to the front of the stage and be a rock star.
Yeah.
So, you know, that has become like a really a big obsession for me. I have essentially integrated that workflow into everything I do to free up the artists on stage. You know, they don't have to change the patches on the keys. Like, their automation gets automated. Their guitar sounds change automatically. All of the vocal effects happen on their own. I built a show that went to Broadway for about 4 months last year, and that entire show was automated from playback, like literally everything. Vocals, time code, the monitor console, the front of house console, the visuals, every single patch change for the electronic drums, the guitar player, the bass player, the keyboard player, like everything was being controlled via MIDI. And I know a lot of people are against it in terms of there's a lot of things that can go wrong, but like I had weeks and weeks and weeks of prep to make sure it was functional and not going to go down. Like, I would never send somebody out with something that I wasn't sure about.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, it's become a wild obsession in terms of like after I'm really done with the show build, like arrangements and everything, the rest of it becomes like heavy about the integration and MIDI and how we're going to get it done. And you know, playback is such a massive part of every top 40 act now, even with a massive band on stage. It's just part of how we roll. I look at it like another band member.
Well said.
And I don't look at it like cheating. I don't look at it like covering something that shouldn't be there. It is just not. You've got to move with the time, and we are at a period of time that like we just need the show to sound big. It's like you go into a circus and just having a guy run around on the stage and then putting him on a unicycle and being like, well, now he's cheating because there's another tool there. It's like, I don't look at it. It's a show. I've always looked at it like our job is to make you impressed. However that happens, that's all that matters. Like, I am only looking at it from the perspective of an audience member walking away being like, I had the best time ever, and whatever I need to do to make that happen is what has to happen.
Yeah, that is great perspective. And you do have to take into account the people that have paid what in this day and age is a lot of money to be in those seats, and they do need to walk out feeling like every dollar was worth it. And they're not even going to go and talk about how much they paid for their ticket. They're going to talk all about what a great show it was. As we head into the home stretch here, despite everything that we've talked about, all the different hats that you've worn, in the lead up to today, you mentioned to me that you're actually transitioning into mixing and production pretty much full time. Tell us about that, including, is it easier said than done, though, when an artist comes calling for a live gig? Is it you know what, Bruce, I got to be honest, those are hard to resist. I'll probably still say yes.
Yeah, and I do. Like, I'm still playing for Rule, and I'll still play for, you know, anyone that really wants me there for me. You know, like, I want somebody to hire me because they know I'm going to do a great job, and they want my sound. You know, that's a big part of it. And I will still do that. You know, I just have such a massive fascination with production and mixing. It's a super creative environment. It's challenging to my mind. Mm. And that's a big thing for me. Like, I really always want to learn and know more and test my ears and, like, you know, do everything I can from that perspective, and have had, like, quite a bit of success, you know, with that thing. I have, like, presets and all sorts of amazing plugins and companies that, like, when I was a teenager making records, would never have imagined my name would be in the menu next to, like, one of the biggest mixing engineers of all time. Mm. It's just a really weird thing to see now. And, you know, as the success comes through with it, it becomes more and more of an apparent thing to me that this is something I should, like, really lean into. I had a iTunes pop number one a couple weeks ago with an artist named Maisie K. And, you know, this has all been, you know, a buildup of lots of production and mixing success over the last couple of years, and expansion of my secondary studio, which is a mixing room with a, again, same kind of concept, lots of outboard gear. And I know people are moving in the box, but I just love the tactile function of production on and mixing on real tools, and being able to turn things and really feel and hear a difference. And yes, it is definitely one of those things where I'm like, and we'll probably never not go on tour or not play gigs or not do sessions. You know, I'm at the core, you know, a musician that plays. Mm. But I think that gives me a ginormous advantage as a production guy and mixer, that yeah, my ears are tuned for music, not just technical application.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And we can hear the joy in your voice. We can hear the enthusiasm. We can hear the excitement, how much you enjoy doing it. And like you said, it does still stimulate creativity. So if you're happy and getting so much enjoyment out of mixing and production, then why wouldn't you stick with it? After all, you have that fantastic studio. You want to be there as much as you can. And like you said, you still have the freedom to go out once in a while when the phone rings of someone that wants you to go out and perform live with them. We're going to close today with the song that you just heard Mike briefly mention. He produced and mixed it. It went to number one on the iTunes pop charts a couple weeks ago. It's called Technicolor Honeymoon by Maisie K. Mike, before I let you go and I play that, tell us all about this track first, if you would, please.
Yeah, and a short, tiny story about Maisie was and is one of my music directing clients. And I built her show when she went out last year. And every show I ever build, I add lots of stuff. I try to make it sound bigger. And, you know, that show ended up being, like, really massive sounding. And everyone at the label and management were like, this is great. And I was just saying, hey, let me take a crack at the next record.
Mm.
Because I also do this, and I think I can do a good job. Technicolor Honeymoon was the first song I took a crack at.
Wow.
And obviously it's done great. And I played everything on this song. A great friend of mine named Dan Viafore worked on the vocals with me on this one. But in terms of, like, all the instrumentation and drums and bass and guitars and everything you're hearing, it's all me.
Wow.
Plus production and the mix. And the vocal tracking, all that stuff was done at MySpace. And, you know, this was like my trying to prove a point to the management and label and stuff, like, hey, here's what I can do. Like, let's work on the rest of the record. And it has resulted in me working on the rest of Maisie's album, which I'm currently doing. But I'm really proud of this song. Like, you know, I had almost forgotten about it because it took so long between, I think I finished it in maybe November of last year.
Mm.
And it only came out, you know, several weeks ago. So, you know, the way those things work, you kind of forget about them. And then I go back and listen to it, and I'm like, man, this really worked. It sounds great. And obviously has done some really cool things, and I'm proud of it.
No doubt. No doubt you should be. Congratulations on it going to number one on the iTunes pop charts. So great to meet you, Mike. Thank you for making time to be on Now Hear This Entertainment. I enjoyed the conversation.
You too. Yes. Thank you.
With that, I will wrap up another new episode of Now Hear This Entertainment. My sincere thanks to music director, producer, session drummer, composer, and mix engineer Mike Avename. do visit his official website at mikeavaname.com. Again, I will have a link to it on the show page for this episode on my podcast website, nhte.net. As I mentioned before, once you land there, look for information on the studio you heard him talk about having built in the NoHo Arts District of LA. There's an equipment list on his website, and regardless of your location, you will want to look at the information on the ability to book a remote session from his studio and what he can do for you. Be sure to engage with him on social media. At the bottom of his website, there are logos to connect with Mike on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. This morning, I followed him on all three of those, and I'm sure he would appreciate you doing the same. Don't forget that he is on YouTube as well, like I said before, to the tune of a combined total of over 226,000 views on his official channel. I do truly hope that you like this show, that you're enjoying what I'm doing every week on the Now Hear This Entertainment podcast. If you've made it all the way to the end, thank you for having stuck with Mike and I, and I'm going to assume that that means that you do like the podcast. You can take action to let me know that you appreciate the work that I do to keep making this show happen every week, every month, more than 10 years without missing once, by going on my podcast website, nhte.net, and then using the yellow Buy Me a Coffee logo that you will see there. This is not a sponsor. It's not affiliated with any brand or chain. It's just a fun way for you to send your support, your thanks to me, including a note that I will see when you utilize that option. You can also just head directly to buymeacoffee.com/BruceW. That's going to do it for episode 538. Thanks ever so much for listening. I'll send you out today with another song produced and mixed by Mike Avaname, as performed by Maisie Kay. This is the one he just talked about. It's called Technicolor Honeymoon.
I lie still and hold my breath. I just want to let you sleep. Constellations on your chest and the rhythm of your heartbeat. Technique.